Okay. All right, it looks like we are all present. We are on our second case of our calendar this morning. I'm Tracy Smith. Good morning, counsel. You're here with Judges Hooten, Frisch, and me on this second case. I know that we checked your sound and it all sounded good. So I am just going to call the case and then we will begin. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument and counsel for appellant 5 minutes rebuttal. So the case this morning, and we'll mute ourselves whenever we're not speaking. The case this morning is 820-0557, Candy Michelle Ostland, appellant versus State of Minnesota, respondent. Counsel for appellant, if you can begin, state your name and the party you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Katie Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of appellant Candy Michelle Ostland. The only issue before this court today is whether the district court abused its discretion in denying Ms. Ostland's petition for post-conviction relief, when in doing so, the court failed to address the issues raised or the evidence in support, and the court did so without granting an evidentiary hearing. Now, this case has
Can I just jump in on the evidentiary hearing and deal with that?
Yes.
As I understand that your post-conviction petition, basically your argument is that the court found in the disposition phase of the probation revocation hearing, found facts related to driving while impaired and also having a firearm. And I think your argument is the record did not support those findings at the probation revocation hearing because in fact they at least with respect to the firearm, they are in fact denied. And the only thing at disposition should have been the facts that, or the probation violations that were in fact admitted. I'm not sure if the question is probation revocation hearing record didn't support what the district court did, I'm not sure why there would be a hearing at post-conviction. Because the hearing, at evidentiary hearing, what is that going to do? It can't change what the record is at the probation revocation hearing, which is maybe why it wasn't asked for. If the question at post-conviction was, hey, the record is not there at the probation revocation hearing, that's the error. There's no need for an evidentiary hearing, is there?
While that may be true, in this case, the abuse of discretion was not the court's failure to grant an evidentiary hearing. If the basis was the revocation was due to her alleged involvement with firearms and driving under the influence. Those were not supported.
But you're not disputing the fact that she committed a felony during probation and that alone would be a basis for revocation.
We do not dispute the fact that she admitted to failing to remain law-abiding because she did incur a new felony conviction for second-degree burglary. What we are disputing are the other bases the court relied upon when revoking her probation. And the court relied upon her alleged involvement with firearms and the allegation that she had been driving all over the countryside under the influence of methamphetamine. Those were not supported by the record. And in fact, were never even alleged. The driving offense was not alleged in the probation violation report. It was never charged. There's nothing in the record to indicate that that was ever even part of the revocation proceedings.
And so, counsel, here's at least one question for you, which is, if we look at, there's a admit deny hearing, your client admits to some. Your complaint, which, speaking for myself, I understand, is once you get to the disposition hearing, all of a sudden there are other facts of wrongdoing that are coming, that are being argued as coming into play as a basis for the disposition that was supposed to be argued then. I guess my question at that point is, what kind of facts can a district court find at disposition time in deciding whether to revoke or not? Is there fact finding to be done?
No, at the disposition phase, there shouldn't be any additional fact finding. The court must rely on the evidence that's been presented. And then the disposition phase is merely to make arguments, but those arguments must be based on the evidence that's presented in the admit deny hearing, or if the parties have agreed to submit additional, you know, evidence in support of the disposition. But this is not that case. There was no evidence in support of the arguments made by the state. So, well, really,
counsel. So, I mean, this is an odd procedure. This is an odd case procedurally. And putting aside whether there's a waiver here, and we look at this at under a plain error standard, if we look at this appeal from a denial of a post-conviction petition under a traditional standard of review for a post-conviction hearing, for post-conviction petition denial, we review that for abuse of discretion, meaning the findings are against the logic and facts in the record. And there are facts in the record that while your client was driving to the new offense, she was drug tested immediately after this offense and found to have tested positive. So it's not an unreasonable conclusion, given that she admitted to driving and there is a positive drug test, that she was actually driving under the influence.
That's not exactly accurate regarding the facts in the record. There is no admission by Ms. Oslin that she was driving during the time of this offense. And there was no admission that she was driving under the influence of methamphetamine.
Now, the test— I know she didn't admit to driving under the influence of methamphetamine, but she did admit to driving the car.
She admitted that she had ingested methamphetamine 2 days prior, and she was given a screening test, and that test was never confirmed. That's both the violation reports indicate that the screening test showed an indication for a positive for methamphetamine, and both reports indicated that those tests had been sent off for confirmation at two different testing sites. And at the time of the disposition hearing and the admit-deny hearing, those test results were not provided to the court. They were not in the record. But yes, she did admit that 2 days prior she had ingested methamphetamine, but she never admitted that she was driving a vehicle while under the influence of methamphetamine.
Did she admit to driving?
The record is sketchy at best on whether she was driving at the time of the offense. I believe in one police report, she indicated that she had been driving her son-in-law to see his mother to get a birth certificate, but it does not indicate whether she had been driving at the time they went to the burglary was committed.
So that sort of circles back to my initial question, is what facts can a district court find, and what, I guess, amplifying that, what can it look at the disposition time to find those facts? Because if the admissions were to violations, you know, 1, 2, and 4 or whatever, but not 3 here, and then there was no charged violation related to driving under the influence, right? There was no noticed violation, I should say. I mean, can a district court just look at, if the state doesn't come forward to prove up that violation or otherwise prove it up in some way at the disposition hearing, saying, yeah, you've denied something, I'm going to now prove it up. Can the district court look at other, at any of the underlying records at the disposition time?
So I think that your question poses several answers I'd like to touch on. First of all, the biggest issue that your question points to is whether a district court's decision to revoke probation can be based on the arguments by the state rather than the evidence in the record. And what the court is permitted to review and to use as a basis for revoking probation is what has been presented to the court during those probation revocation proceedings. That would be the probation violation report that was filed, the documents that the parties have acknowledged the court can rely on in making its decision. And the reason that we have to have evidence to support a district court's finding in revoking probation is so that the state can't come in and make arguments that aren't supported by the record under such circumstances. Specifically in this case, I think it's important to point out that although it's not required to have the same judge that imposed a sentence or that even accepted the admissions and the denials at an admit-deny hearing, it means something in this case that the judge who heard the dispositional arguments here did not have the benefit of being at that admit-deny hearing. He was not the sentencing
judge. But counsel,
judge.
At getting back to what the district court can look at, mm-hmm. It wasn't just arguments of counsel then that the district court had in front of it. It had the notice of violation and the appended complaint and other reports, right? But I think your argument still is that if they're not admitted to and we're at disposition, the court shouldn't go searching through those documents for unadmitted violations. Correct. Am I wrong about that?
No,
that
that's you're
your
not.
Argument? Okay.
And in this case, you look to the record of the admit-deny hearing. What evidence was proven up at that hearing? And when the state appeared at the admit-deny hearing, they had made no attempt to prove the firearm violations. In fact, they made no attempt to prove any violations. They merely accepted the few admissions that Ms. Oslin laid forth and stated that they would accept those and move forward to the dispositional hearing. So the state made no attempt to prove any of the violation behavior.
So putting aside the arguments that you're making, the district court didn't actually make findings that your client was actually driving under the influence or using a firearm. The district court revoked probation because there was a new felony offense. In fact, specifically stated it was revoking probation because of a new felony offense. And then after stating that, said, I also have concerns about you. I'm familiar with you. This offense in general involved a firearm. Didn't say she had a firearm, but said it involved a firearm. What's improper about the district court expressing its concerns about the totality of circumstances that gave rise to the reason why your client was in court for a probation revocation?
While the court did state that it could have based its revocation decision on a new felony alone, the court went on to consider the arguments by the state and formed and used that to form the basis of its decision to revoke. And specifically, the court found that despite Ms. Oslin's proven success, that the sheer involvement of firearms was enough concern to revoke probation after nearly 10 years violation free.
But that's not what the district court said. The district court said the court believes that the Norman County offense alone is sufficient to support revocation and disposition to the commissioner in this case. Alone.
Correct. That it is sufficient. That's what the court stated. But then the court went on to make further findings in revoking her probation.
But are they really findings? Or is it just an explanation of this is other stuff in the record?
The court explicitly stated in the probation violation hearing transcript at page 21 that the firearm involvement was enough to revoke probation. The sheer involvement of firearms was enough to revoke probation.
Where's that? Are you quoting that? I don't see that quote.
I believe the sheer involvement isn't an exact quote, but
yeah,
it's on page 21 of the probation violation hearing transcript.
But aren't you arguing that the court basically made findings that she was under the influence while driving, and the court made findings that she was guilty of a firearm theft type violation, when the only thing in the record is that she admitted the Norman County offense and she admitted the circumstances of that offense, right? That's what she admitted to.
She admitted that she had incurred a conviction for second degree burglary.
Right, and she admitted the facts surrounding that burglary, correct?
She admitted to specific facts surrounding that burglary and specifically that she was present when it occurred.
Right. And one of the facts that of that burglary was that a firearm was found in the car. Now, she claimed she didn't know anything about it, but that was one of the facts that was part of that burglary. Am I correct?
Correct. But the fact
right.
that But and it's so not the in the judge, record that she knew anything about it or was involved in that.
All right. So the judge, though, and I'm just reading, it says it's obvious with the burglary and the driving conduct, even though not convicted of any driving related conduct, it was still involved in this matter. In other words, she's just basically saying, well, you may not be guilty of a burglary involving a firearm, because you didn't know this was going to happen, I'm still noting that you were involved with someone who and that a gun was involved, a firearm was involved in this burglary. So to that extent, you know, I mean, I think it was in the context of what public safety is implicated. Why is that an abuse of discretion for a judge to look at that? and so, analyze it that way.
So that specific quote you referenced began with the judge's concern over this driving conduct and how that puts the public at risk. That is nowhere in the record. There was never even an allegation in the violation report to begin with that she had ever driven under the influence of methamphetamine. And that's clearly part of the basis of the court's decision here, and that appellant was somehow involved in firearms. And I think it's important to take those statements from the court in the context of the arguments made by the state. To quote one of the many arguments made by the state, if you think that breaking into someone's houses and stealing firearms while under the influence of methamphetamine and driving a motor vehicle across the countryside is the same as simply having a small amount of a controlled substance in a park or school zone and you being under the influence, Judge, that's your call to make. But I think you're comparing apples and oranges. And again,
Counsel, because we're running out of time for you, I mean, I appreciate the argument that you're making. When we get to the end of it, though, I think my question was, and Judge Frisch spoke to it, is when the court says they think that it thinks the Norman County offense alone is sufficient, it strikes me that your remedy in any event would be a remand for the district court to reconsider its revocation decision limited to the facts of the admitted conduct. And don't we already know from the district court statement right there what it would do? I don't really know why the remedy would be not to revoke. It seems like if there are factual errors in the decision to revoke, then a remedy would be to, okay, re-exercise your discretion on the basis of this record supported findings. But it seems like, wouldn't that be a moot exercise since the district court already told us?
Absolutely not. We can't infer, excuse me, may I finish my response?
Thank you, yes.
We can't infer what the court would or would not have done if it did not have these, you know, clearly erroneous facts presented to it. It's clear that at the very least, the court considered these clearly erroneous facts in deciding whether to revoke her probation. And although the court indicated it could have revoked the probation based alone on the new offense, it may not have. Just because probation can be revoked, just because policy considerations may allow it, doesn't mean it's appropriate. And in this case, the court could have, as probation requested, allow her to serve that burglary sentence and then go back to her remaining 20 years of supervision. She could have had a severe and meaningful sanction and then be returned to probation. And we can't for sure say whether that would have happened without these clearly erroneous facts.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Greg Widseth, and as the Polk County attorney, I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this case. As the court's aware, this is a post-conviction appeal from the court's denial of the appellant's petition for post-conviction relief. And as such, it's a collateral attack on a conviction and a sentence which carry with them a presumption of validity. And as the court's already stated, the standard review here is an abuse of discretion. And because it is a post-conviction appeal or an appeal from a post-conviction, Your Honors, it's also the appellant's burden to establish. And the appellants failed to do that in this case. As with any probation revocation proceeding, the court's required to engage in an analysis of the Austin factors and to make the appropriate findings.
So if the appellant here very specifically at the admit denied said, I deny involvement with the firearm, and the state didn't go ahead and put in any, try to prove that up. It seems like it went for it. Let's go to disposition now on the admitted violations. It didn't pry and prove up and get a ruling on other violations, specifically the firearm. It's denied. The state didn't seek a ruling to find that proved. It just goes to disposition. Why isn't it not supported by the record and just kind of unfair to get to disposition and then say, well, we're going to rely on the firearm as an important public safety reason to revoke without even considering whether she had any knowledge of the firearm at all? Why would that be held against her?
Well, she denied knowledge of the firearm, that the firearm was involved in the burglary. But if the court looked at this case, you would see that she entered an admission to violation number one, which was failing to remain law abiding. And that failing to remain law abiding was the burglary offense that was committed down in Norman County. And as part of violation number one, and the probation violation was filed here, the complaint was filed with that case. And there's only one thing that was alleged to have been stolen in that burglary, and that was two firearms.
You argue, I think, that when the admit deny hearing is done and the violations, which I think is to, and then it went to disposition. I guess my question is, the first Austin factor is, have there been violations, right? Have there been intentional violations?
Correct.
And as I understood it, when it went to disposition, that the violations are then set at that point. They're either admitted to or they've been found by the court. And what it strikes me is that the state is arguing, no, when it gets to disposition, we get to prove up and the court gets to infer and find additional wrongdoing that justifies revocation, additional beyond what we ended with at the last hearing, that this disposition is about inferring and finding additional facts of wrongdoing. Is that what the disposition hearing is for?
No, I think it's for the court to evaluate, you know, when you get to disposition here. One of the things here is appellant waived her right to a contested hearing and she entered admissions. And she entered admissions and by doing that—
Where did she waive her right to a contested hearing on the firearm charge? Did she ever waive her right to a contested hearing on the firearm violation alleged?
You mean the theft of the firearm?
Correct.
No, she didn't. In fact, she wasn't convicted of that, and that wasn't something that she admitted to.
Okay, so she didn't.
But she did admit to committing a burglary in the second degree in Norman County with her co-defendant.
Right, she admitted. She didn't waive a hearing, she admitted.
Correct. I mean,
okay. As part of that admission, did she admit that a firearm was involved, even though she wasn't charged with it, that a firearm was involved with that burglary?
Correct. But she said she claimed she didn't have any knowledge of it. And then we go back to the whole issue of, well, the state didn't prove up this firearm. Well, the defendant waived her right when she entered that admission.
Waived her right to what?
What?
Waived her right to what?
The state having to prove up that there was, that this burglary involved the burglary of a firearm.
Because she had, how did she, because the complaint references a firearm, the complaint on the burglary?
And that's the only thing it references that was stolen in this burglary.
And so what would she, sounds less like you think that she needed to waive or contest it. I'm not sure what she'd be contesting. There wasn't a notice of violation. Was there a notice of violation related to the, I should know this. Was that one of the?
To the what?
To the firearm.
So the violation, the original violation or the addendum had four violations, failing to remain law abiding, not purchase, possess, or use or carry any type of dangerous weapon here, a firearm.
Okay, so she denied that, but you're saying that's irrelevant. She needed to contest the underlying facts of the burglary that she admitted to in order to avoid having the firearm used against her later?
That's my position, in that by when she says, I'm waiving my right to a contested hearing, just as the defendant did in Jiang, the State v. Jiang case that we cited, that relieves the state of having to go forward and prove that up. And as they said in Jiang, the petitioner waives the first part of the revocation hearing, which is contesting the allegations. And here she waived that with respect to failing to remain law-abiding, committing the burglary. The state is no longer obligated to present evidence to prove the violations, and the district court may base its findings on the violation report and the probationer's waiver, which serves as a stipulation to the state's allegations in the violation report. Regardless if she pled guilty to a first degree burglary or she did here a second degree burglary here, the complaint that she did that under is attached to the violation. And the only thing that's alleged to have been stolen in that burglary is a firearm.
In order to not have the firearm used against her at disposition, you're saying she could have admitted to having participated in the burglary, but needed to contest that the burglary involved her knowledge of the specifics of the burglary.
Yes, which would be tough to do, because then you go back to the issues of anything, you know, when you're dealing with accomplice liability, anything that's reasonably foreseeable. Is it reasonably foreseeable when you break into a house that you might steal a firearm or cash or drugs or anything else? Well, that's a determination that the district court would have to make. But that was never done here because she entered the admission. But I think, you know, really when it boils down to it, one of the things about this case is, and I think the courts hit it right on the head, is that the court went through and made the evaluation of the Austin factors here. And the court specifically referred to Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Section 3B, which says that revocations of a state sentence and commitment is justified when an offender is convicted of a new felony offense for which the guidelines recommend prison. Here, the defendant was convicted of burglary in the second degree, and the presumptive sentence that was imposed was 43 months in prison. And the district court, based upon that, specifically stated, as the court's already noted, the court believes that the Norman County offense alone is sufficient to support revocation and disposition to the commissioner in this case. So any findings that are after that, whether they involve a firearm or driving under the influence of meth, and we know she was tested positive for meth by her own admission, and she admitted violation number two, which is, testing positive for meth and using methamphetamine.
And what's the proof of her driving conduct? I think that's the argument, that her driving conduct was found. That's the argument by the court when a court refers to her driving conduct. And what's the record that supports that driving conduct, which I assume means driving under the influence?
Again, it was the complaint here and her admission to driving the defendant to the location where the burglary was committed, admitted to using meth 2 days before and testing positive after that. I mean, immediately, because when the cops get there, if you look at the complaint, the cops get there and they find her and the co-defendant hiding in the ditch. So this isn't someone that doesn't have an idea that something wrong is going on here. She's not standing out inside going, geez, I just brought him over here to do something and I didn't have any idea what he was doing. She's hiding in the ditch when the police come up there, but she admits to driving and she tests positive for meth immediately after being arrested, not only with her probation officer, but also with the law enforcement officers. But really those findings become superfluous because the court made a finding that offense in and of itself was sufficient to justify execution of the sentence. And that's what the sentencing guidelines say. And the fact, we have to go back here to the procedural posture in that it's the defense's burden to establish that the court clearly abused its discretion. And the appellant doesn't cite to a single case, not a published case, not an unpublished case of this court or the Minnesota Supreme Court holding that a district court clearly abuses its discretion by following that provision of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines. In fact, it's interesting to note that despite that issue being briefed at the district court, appellant doesn't address it in her principal brief and doesn't address it in her reply brief, doesn't even acknowledge that section exists. They just
ignore. I think the argument is not that the district court couldn't revoke probation here, but that the discretion that the district court in fact exercised, because there is discretion that the district courts exercise, was infected by clearly erroneous factual findings. And if that's the case, then the district court needs to exercise its discretion in accordance with the supported facts. I think that's the argument, not whether it's impossible to revoke on a basis of a burglary later.
No, but the court came to the conclusion that was sufficient to execute in and of itself. That's supported by the guidelines, that's supported by the case law. And the fact that the court did that and made that finding and specifically stated that they believe that that's sufficient alone, you don't have to go any further than that. Because again, we're at post-conviction proceedings here and it's the appellant's burden to show that the court clearly abused its discretion. And you can't do it with respect to that finding. And again, after that, all of those other findings really become superfluous. And you get to the thing that less judicial tolerance, that same section, less judicial tolerance is urged for offenders who were convicted of more serious offense or who had a longer criminal history. Here, the defendant received a dispositional departure, and this was a more severe offense. I know the defense argues it wasn't a severe offense. Well, that's directly contrary to what the Supreme Court said in Osborne, which is that controlled substance crime in the first degree can properly be characterized as severe. It's a severity level 9 offense. It's the most serious drug offense we have. And this defendant's appellant in that underlying offense wasn't just simply smurfing drugs. She admitted to stealing drugs on numerous occasions, to manufacturing meth on, I mean, she admitted that the allegations in the complaint were true, which from her own statement in there, she was manufacturing meth on a weekly basis, all the way down to November 14th, when she and her co-defendant there went to Walmart in Crookston, bought Sudafed at about 6:15 in the evening. And coincidentally at 5 o'clock the next morning, there's a fire over in Grant Forks based upon her and her co-defendant finishing off some methamphetamine. So the court was proper to consider that this was a more severe offense. And again, the defendant's entitled to less judicial forbearance with respect to that. Really, this case, when it boils down to it, comes back to the fact that the district court's denial of appellant's petition for post-conviction relief wasn't a clear abuse of discretion when it executed a probationary sentence, in fact, a probationary sentence that was a dispositional departure, a case where we presume that she should have been sentenced to prison after she was convicted of a felony offense, which also carried with it a commitment to prison. And I think it really goes back to what Ms. Lockwood finished with and what is on the last page one of the last pages of her principal brief, and that is that the district court could easily have given Oslin a chance to return to probation and serve out the remaining 20 years of her 30-year probationary period. The fact that the district court had a choice between two proper alternatives and chose a course of action doesn't mean that it clearly abused its discretion by rejecting the alternative advanced by the appellant. And again,
Can I ask you this? I mean, I think when she pled guilty to the second degree burglary charge, and I assume as part of her guilty plea, she pled to the underlying facts of that charge. Does that, when she admits that felony, does that, as part of a revocation hearing, does that necessarily mean that that guilty plea is incorporated by reference into the record?
You mean the complaint or what's?
The guilty plea, I assume, involved a reference to the complaint, which is.
I would assume it did, Your Honor. Obviously, it's not part of the record here, but I think the court, when that complaint is attached to the allegation that she failed to remain law-abiding and then she enters an admission to committing offense, that's a burglary. And the only thing that's alleged to have been burglarized is a firearm, that the court's within its authority to consider that evidence, at least in making the balancing act, which is what we're talking about here at disposition, in balancing the Austin factors.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up. I don't know if you had a closing thought or you good?
I'm good, okay. Your Honor. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start by...
Ms. Lockwood, I just want to start... I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I do want to just follow up on something that you said at the end of your primary argument. And that was that the district court had clearly erroneous facts presented to it at the disposition hearing. Now, those were unobjected to, correct?
Correct.
All right. So when I'm looking at the transcript of the plea of the disposition hearing, the prosecutor does go in at some length about the involvement of firearms by the co-defendant, the accomplice, and the driving conduct based on the admission, right? So those are unobjected to evidentiary issues, correct?
No.
So where was the objection in this transcript? Because I don't see it.
There are arguments made by the state. It's not evidence in support of the violations. It's merely arguments made by the state.
But there's no objection to these arguments.
That's correct. And there's no requirement that to get review of the basis upon which a probation revocation is based. There's no requirement to object. What she did was she refuted these statements by saying that's not the case. That's not true. Her attorney made arguments against what the state had presented. And then the court sided with the state.
So when the state characterizes this evidence in its argument for disposition, and there is no objection at the time that the state is characterizing these evidence, how do we review that? Do we review it for plain error? Do we review it for abuse of discretion?
You review it for abuse of discretion because you
What's
have to
the look- authority for that?
The authority is, well, you look to how those facts were used. The only time a plain error analysis has ever been applied in a probation revocation context is when it is a constitutional issue or a clear issue of prosecutorial misconduct.
So
that's
in a
not
probation,
what we have in this case.
So in a probation revocation hearing, the district court is essentially acting as a fact finder and can make credibility determinations based on its assessment of the record or the arguments and of counsel, how they characterize it.
This is a dispositional hearing though, and that's the difference. And she did not waive the contested violation hearing. She had a contested violation hearing. And at that point, yes, she did. She had a contested violation hearing. She did not waive that part of the probation violation proceedings.
Where was that? When was that?
It was on the June 21st of 2018. That's where she made admissions and made denials. That is what happens at a contested violation hearing. And that was the point where the state had the burden. And that was going to be my first point. Yes, I have the burden in a post-conviction petition and on appeal. But the state had the burden to prove the violations at that admit-deny hearing if she denied. It chose not to, so the state can't circumvent that burden by then bringing in those allegations at the dispositional hearing.
Yeah, I think that the issue that seems to be at stake here is how much of the supporting documents of the complaint, et cetera, get to be relied on at disposition or get to be considered essentially admitted to by the appellant when she admits to the burglary, right?
Yes, I mean, and Your Honor, at that admit-deny hearing, the evidence presented by Ms. Ostlund's counsel in her admission to the burglary was she's denying the firearm violation, and that's because there was no evidence that firearms were involved. So he presented an argument against that, and the court did not try to prove the firearm violation. They just left it alone.
The state did not try to prove
Excuse me. Yes, thank you. The state did not try to go any further trying to prove that.
Can I go back to Judge Frisch's a question to you with regard to what the judge said here? Is there any indication in this record that the judge found that she was convicted of a firearm violation or driving conduct? In fact, doesn't the judge say the opposite? She hasn't been convicted of those charges.
The judge says, although not convicted, there's concerns that of firearm involvement, especially when someone is using methamphetamine.
All right. Now, why is that? I mean, there was no objection made here. Why is that finding that a firearm was involved in with this burglary clearly erroneous?
Well, first of all, you can't object before a finding is made. And when the court makes the finding that forms the basis of a revocation, then you appeal or challenge that revocation decision, which is exactly what happened here. And that finding is clearly erroneous because it's not supported by the facts in the record, the facts that the court was permitted to rely on. It's only supported by the arguments made by the state. And when someone denies involvement with a firearm at the admit-deny hearing where the evidence can be presented.
But she didn't deny that she was involved with the firearm. It says on page 4 of that transcript that from her counsel, she admitted she was with him and he was the one with the firearm. So there is some involvement there because she's the accomplice to him who has the firearm.
But immediately after that, there's a statement from her attorney about how the firearm charge was dismissed because they discovered, or I don't have the transcript right in front of me, but the language is that she had no involvement in the firearm or no knowledge of it. She admitted that she was with him at the time of the offense, but she was found in a completely separate piece of the property and had no knowledge of what he was doing in the house and what he had taken from the house. And again, we supplied an affidavit as evidence for the post-conviction petition in support of that as well.
But how is that different than what the judge found? I mean, your explanation, she was never charged with this, but she admitted she was with him and that a firearm was involved. that the burglary involved a firearm. How is that different than what the judge said here?
I see my time.
The judge recognized that.
May I respond?
Yes.
Please, counsel, thank you.
The judge recognized that there was an allegation in the criminal complaint that a firearm was involved. He had no right to recognize or to find that she had any involvement in the firearm. She pled guilty to the burglary, an amended burglary 2 charge. She did not ever admit or plead guilty to any knowledge of or involvement with a firearm, simply because a separate co-defendant at that same location took firearms from the residence without her knowledge, and that was placed in the criminal complaint. That is not facts that were presented to the court that it may consider at the dispositional phase of a hearing when there's been no allegation that she was involved in firearms. So we'd ask that this court reverse.
Well, I think that, and I'm quoting now, it's obvious with the burglary, and I'll skip over, it still was involved. Even though not convicted of any driving related conduct, it was still involved in this matter. And it's involved in the offense. I mean, so that's as far as the judge went, right?
And that's very concerning because there's no facts in the record to support that. And that's what formed the basis of the court's decision to revoke. We have to look to the evidence presented at the admit-deny hearing, which she did not waive. And I'll point out the only cases that discuss plain error are in the context of a waived admit-deny hearing. That's not what happened.
But if she pled guilty to the charges in the complaint, doesn't that necessarily involve those facts if she pled guilty?
She did not plead guilty to the charges in the complaint. She pled guilty to an amended charge of second degree burglary. It was not out of that original complaint to which she pled.
And the second degree followed because it would have been first if it was a weapon involved and she pleaded guilty to
second
degree.
Correct. Okay. And the reasoning given at the admit deny hearing was because that the evidence presented indicated she was not involved and had no knowledge of firearms.
Thank you. My colleagues, any more questions? Okay, counsel, both counsel, thank you very much for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period.